Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is by Catherine Bindley. Meetings, chats, dates, all are being recorded. And Sarah Nassauer has an article, Costco cashier feels like $1 million. Aileen Woodward wrote, hormones explain why women feel pain longer. Andrea Peterson has an article, coffee drinking is linked to heart benefits. We'll follow that up with Elizabeth Bernstein's some therapists encourage estrangement to help heal. And we do have one more by Mary Marslander. Can we kill you for your organs, please? All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. Meetings, chats, dates, all are being recorded. To record or not to record? That is no longer a question for people in tech. The answer is a resounding yes. A Zoom call is not complete without an artificial intelligence note taker. Phones are out at meetings, capturing every word. During impromptu conversations with coworkers, someone might turn on the Granola transcription app, which can turn the interactions into one-page summaries or a list of action items. Even at bars and on dates, people are using AI-infused listening apps to analyze conversations later on. Gone are the days of any interaction being private by default. Asking for permission is out, even though in some situations, that could mean violating the law. It is not creepy if it's in the name of productivity, the people doing the recordings say. It happens on a daily basis, said Eric Bond, a venture capitalist in San Francisco, who started noticing about a year ago. During his meetings with founders, they put phones out on the conference table and then inch them towards him, like he is an athlete at a post-game interview. Bond used to ask if he was being recorded. The answer was always yes, followed by, is that okay? Nowadays, he just assumes they are and chooses his words more carefully. I just see this as normal protocol, he said. Our society is moving to a state of East Germany. With the rise of camera-equipped smart glasses, AI recording bracelets, and other covert devices, a societal shift is underway. It is not clear how much say we will have in the matter, or how much our conversations will change if we all know they are being entered into the permanent record. Jimmy Chang, founder of a startup that Bond's firm invests in that provides sales data intelligence, uses AI to transcribe every conversation she can. At a work conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico, back in May, Chang wore a small pin with a red light indicating it was recording. Someone who worked at the conference eventually approached Chang and told her the device was making people uncomfortable. She found the request to stop recording triggering. My thing, she says, I'm not attributing who said what, it's for my general knowledge. Chang is also taking to recording most of her first dates, usually with granola. She puts her phone out on the table or her chair, and then once the date is through, she has the feed automatically sent to Anthropic's Claude to report back on how she did. Can I be more engaging and empathetic? She says she might ask Claude. What are the percentages of me talking versus them talking? Michelle Lim, chief executive of a small AI startup, said she was initially shocked when, about a year ago, very specific words she had used during a phone call were recited back to her in a follow-up conversation. She was convinced she had been recorded and was upset about it. California is an all-party consent state, meaning it requires all people in a private conversation to agree to be recorded. But Lynn's own feelings on acceptable recording practices have since evolved. Now she just assumes she's being recorded and even encourages the practice within her own company. Granola is enabled for all formally scheduled internal meetings, and when employees are casually catching up at one another's desks, they often turn it on then too. In the office, we actually get really bummed when we realize we're having a conversation and we forget to turn on Granola, she says. I wish there was a Granola in every room. Ask Glenn typically doesn't ask if she's being recorded, even outside the office. It almost kills the mood, she said. AI note takers started appearing in meetings several years ago, but there's usually an indication of their presence. Apps that record or transcribe without any type of alert have taken off more recently. Granola, which was founded in 2023, does not actually record or save an audio file, but it does transcribe conversations word for word. It can then provide summaries and action items. Its mobile app has been downloaded 758,000 times since its launch, according to market intelligence firm Sensor Tower. There is no icon that automatically shows up on a Zoom call and no audio notification when Granola is being used on a phone call. Users can enable a watermark feature for video meetings or choose to have the app send a message in the meeting chat that it's taking notes. In general, laws do not distinguish between recordings and transcriptions. Alex Albin, who teaches privacy law and cybersecurity courses at UCLA School of Law, says people tend to give up privacy to companies they work for. Employees likely have to accept their employer recording or transcribing their chats. But it is different when people are commingling with clients and taking meetings with outside firms. Companies need to be careful about technologies that are automatically recording, especially when it involves third parties, he said. As to whether recording people runs afoul of state consent laws, he said context matters and that there are some gray areas. And now Costco cashier feels like $1 million. Costco cashier Tony Bazaar unloaded his lunch in the break room, clocked in, and headed for the checkout, just as he has for much of the past 4 decades. That day, like most days, the 60-year-old Bazaar was assigned to the self-checkout area, a cluster of 6 registers. At 9:02 a.m., the first shoppers were ready to ring themselves up. "Right here, ma'am," Bazaar said, gesturing for a customer in line to move to an open register. "How you doing today, sir? Find everything all right?" he said to another as he circled the registers with a scanning gun. Long-tenured workers like Bazaar are Costco's secret weapons. They are reliable and experienced, able to speed shoppers through a checkout line, and serve as mentors to newer workers, passing down the company's unique culture, Costco executives said. Bazaar's pay and benefits reflect his value to the company. He earns $32.90 an hour, and the holdings in his 401k have boosted his retirement savings to more than $1 million, he said. His Costco-sponsored healthcare has a regular visit copay of $15 and a specialty visit copay of $25, below the national average. In 2009, his family bought a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house with a pool, and they have traveled to Europe twice over the past decade. "As a younger person, I didn't think me and my family would reach where we sit now," he said. "I could retire, but what would I do? Costco has been good to me." Costco has long paid more than most U.S. retailers to help keep turnover low, a strategy company founders felt would reduce costs associated with training new hires and lead to better customer service. Turnover after 1 year of Costco employment is about 7%, a fraction of industry averages. In recent years, many Costco stores have created the role of culture coach for long-tenured hourly workers like Bizarre to act as official mentors, even if they are not supervisors, an effort to more explicitly use their knowledge to train workers. They also boosted the maximum pay hourly workers can earn to $32.90 from $31.90, increased its annual bonus, and added an extra week of vacation for workers who have been with the company at least 30 years. Costco's effort to keep hourly workers longer, even those like Bizarre who don't want to be promoted, is counter to how many employers view their workforce. Long-tenured employees are typically more expensive, and those who are not interested in promotions are sometimes seen as less valuable. Many thousands of Costco United States hourly workers have over $1 million in their 401k accounts, said Gary Millerchip, the retailer's chief financial officer. The company's investments in workers means that they stay for a long time, then retire, but you have a pipeline of employees coming behind that group that are also building that level of experience, he said. It's also cheaper long term. Costco's annual sales have grown for nearly two decades. Its stock has increased more than 2,000% during that time to a current valuation of $951.60 from a low of about $40 a share in the wake of the 2008 recession. Costco trains managers to view cashiers as specialists, experienced employees who can make or break a member's experience by speeding lines and offering friendly conversation or not. The fastest traditional cashiers check out around 70 shoppers per hour. The average is about 57 per hour. Self-checkouts are slower according to Costco's internal data, but some customers prefer them, workers and executives said. Bizarre's career at Costco reflects the retailer's approach to retention. After a brief stint in community college, then at a local grocery store, a friend said Price Club, a precursor to Costco, was a good place to work. Bizarre applied for a job gathering carts in the parking lot of the Tucson store in 1986. He earned $5.85 an hour, which was up from around $3 an hour at the grocery store, he said. Costco bought the Price Club chain in 1993 and transitioned its pension to a 401k. Bizarre started to put a small amount of his paycheck into the account. After a few years, Bizarre became an early morning stocker, unloading trucks and stamping boxes with a label gun. 5 years later, the mornings were getting to me, he said. He had his first child and craved a more regular schedule. He worked counting and greeting shoppers entering the front door, then was given a role as a cashier. His hourly pay moved to about $10 an hour. That job stuck. He enjoyed handling the money and talking to customers. Zantz did consider other jobs. In his 20s, he applied to become a firefighter several times, following in an older brother's footsteps, but he could not pass the entrance exam, he said. That disappointment was countered by Costco's growth. It just gave me a sense of, don't leave, ride this one out, he said. He also stayed because of the pay and benefits. That became acute last year when his son-in-law ended his life, then months later his wife of 26 years, a former Costco employee in the bakery department, was diagnosed with stage 3 brain cancer. His Costco health insurance covered the full cost of his wife's 3 surgeries. Bizarre took paid leave for nearly a year to help his family. He also used the retailer's therapy benefits to cope, he said, which further drove home how comprehensive the insurance was. You don't have any idea how deep it goes until something tragic happens, he said. He returned to work part-time without a pay cut. Bizarre makes a good self-checkout employee because he is outgoing, attentive to detail, and his voice carries, said Eric Vila, a register area supervisor. About every 30 minutes, front-end supervisors like Vila get a count of how many members' cards have been scanned at the entrance, a gauge of how many shoppers will show up at registers about a half hour later. As of 9:30 a.m., 157 member cards had been scanned. By 10 a.m., the count was 337 cards. Czar put his comfortable black Hoka sneakers to good use as he rapidly circled the bank of self-checkout registers with a scanner gun in hand. When one shopper accidentally scanned a bulk package of cookies twice, Czar lettered the member services to refund the charge to a credit card. Another self-checkout worker, Eddie Lopez, who started at the store 1 year after Bizarre, stepped away from self-checkout to help track down a brand of out-of-stock eye drops for a shopper with one of the front-end computers. More are coming in today, Lopez said. Several longtime shoppers greeted Bizarre like an old friend. I came to get my hug, said a shopper who gave him one. How you doing? Bizarre asked one man who was struggling with his bulky items. Horrible. I just want to get home, he said, sharing that he was healing after a medical procedure. Bizarre helped him scan his items and offered condolences. The registers hum with a steady din of beeps and automated please begin scanning messages. Bizarre has been asked to become a supervisor, but has declined. He likes the direct contact with shoppers as a cashier, and feels he can act as an effective mentor to other employees, in part because he is not their boss. I would say this is my calling right where I'm at. And hormones explain why women feel pain longer. Pain lasts longer for women than it does for men, partly because of differences in testosterone levels, a recent study suggests. Research has long indicated that men generally recover faster from pain and are less likely than women to develop chronic pain. Now scientists have a better idea why. When you get injured, your immune system sends certain white blood cells to calm pain-sensing neurons and inflammation. In men, those white blood cells are more likely to produce a pain-resolving molecule that can quickly quell the ache, according to a recent study in the journal Science Immunology. The testosterone hormone is probably what drives the increased production of that pain-resolving molecule known as interleukin-10, the researchers found. It is not because women are too emotional or too soft and the pain is just in their head, said Jeffrey Lamont, a neuroimmunologist at Michigan State University and study co-author. Researchers examined data from 172 women and 73 men who had gone to emergency rooms across the United States between 2017 and 2021 after experiencing traumatic injuries, mostly from car accidents. The patients rated their pain right after their injuries, then again at 8 weeks and 12 weeks. The men reported their pain went away more quickly. Blood tests revealed the men had more interleukin-10 than the women did. In the lab, Lament's team found male mice recovered more quickly from pain after an injury than female mice, and the male's blood had higher levels of interleukin-10. They honed in on testosterone by experimenting with sex hormone changes in the animals. The group removed the ovaries of some of the female mice and implanted pellets containing a hormone derived from testosterone. These mice had higher interleukin-10 levels and recovered more quickly from pain than female mice who did not receive the procedure. About one quarter of United States adults have chronic pain, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, with 8.5% of Americans experiencing levels that restrict their ability to work or disrupt their daily lives. Existing treatments can have negative side effects and do not always resolve symptoms. Many treatment approaches involve trying to stop what is causing the pain, but just as important is understanding what makes pain go away, according to Ann Rodriguez, a Virginia Tech neuroscientist who was not involved in this study. If we have something that can kind of cut that pain signal, the interleukin-10 molecule is a potential therapeutic avenue, Rodriguez said. Testosterone patches in the right dose applied to the skin might just help, Lamenta said. And now, coffee drinking is linked to heart benefits. There are good news for coffee drinkers. Up to 5 cups of the brew a day are safe for most adults and may even have benefits for heart health, according to a new scientific statement by the American Heart Association. Counting between about 3 to 5 8-ounce cups of Joe daily, or around 400 milligrams of caffeine, is linked to a lower risk of heart disease, heart failure, stroke, and type 2 diabetes, according to the AHA statement published in the journal Circulation. The research on coffee and caffeine has been very mixed, with some studies showing links to benefits and others showing health risks. So the new statement provides some much-needed clarity, said Dr. Eugenia Giannos, a cardiologist at Northwell Health in New York and chair of the American College of Cardiology's Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease Council, who was not involved in the statement. The statement's authors analyzed dozens of studies looking at the impact of coffee and caffeine on heart health. The scientific evidence for coffee's safety and health benefits have been building over time, said Gregory Marcus, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and the statement's lead author. Now we do have a couple more. Some therapists encourage estrangement to help heal. Shoshana Rubley was shocked by her therapist's advice given in her second session, but the counselor was recommended by someone she knew and had impressive credentials, so she did as she was told. She cut off all ties with her mother. It was an argument made from authority, so I followed it, says the 42-year-old freelance marketer. Is it really good therapy to break your mother's heart? After decades of urging families to communicate better and work on their issues together, some therapists are now taking an opposite tact. They're encouraging estrangement as a means of self-care. Proponents of the trend hold that advising patients to consider a cutoff from a relative or spouse they deem toxic or unsupportive can protect their mental health and allow for emotional growth. Meanwhile, critics, many of whom are researchers who have studied relationships for decades, says it encourages self-centeredness and self-delusion and ruins families. Most therapists agree that sometimes people are justified in breaking ties with their parents or a close relative, especially if they were physically or emotionally abusive. What's changing now is the bar for what's deemed abusive enough for a cutoff. We're in a culture where we emphasize fragility. Everything becomes trauma, and the solution increasingly is to split and leave, says William Doherty, a therapist and professor emeritus of family social medicine at the University of Minnesota, who has researched the ways that therapy may be harmful. But it should be the tragic exception that you cut off a parent or loved one, not business as usual in therapy. About 25% of the United States population is estranged from or have cut ties with a close relative at any given time, and 10% is estranged from a parent or child, according to research by Carl Pillemer, a family sociologist and professor of human development at Cornell. Among some 7,000 estranged parents surveyed back in April, a third believed their adult child's therapist had influenced or recommended the decision to end the relationship. A lot of therapists are taught to believe whatever the client is saying at face value, said Peter Anderson, a licensed marriage and family therapist in Beverly, Massachusetts, who helps families with estrangements and conducted the surveys. They're forming conclusions based on one person's account. Social media has played an outside role in both the growing awareness of estrangement and the role of therapists in it. In recent years, the number of users sharing personal stories of how cutoffs have improved mental health has skyrocketed. Meanwhile, therapists and estrangement coaches have been producing a growing slew of offerings, from quizzes, the emotionally immature parent assessment, to courses, navigating a family cutoff, to books, no contact, no guilt. People are coming into a therapist's office and parroting what they hear on social media, Anderson says. They're looking for affirmation for a decision they've already made. Whitney Goodman, a licensed marriage and family therapist in Tampa, Florida, takes the patient's lead when considering estrangement. Trauma and abuse, she says, is in the eye of the beholder. Why are we giving all this deference only to parents? Goodman said. Why aren't we believing the kids? They are adults. Goodman often speaks to her more than 660,000 followers on Instagram and TikTok about estrangement and emotionally immature parents. I reject the argument that we should ignore the impact of abuse because it wasn't considered abuse 75 years ago, she wrote in a recent post. In her work, Goodman sees people who want to go no contact with a parent for everything from drunken driving with grandchildren to dictating future spouses. You have an adult population now who says, I'm going to stand up for myself. I'm not going to do what was always done. Critics, however, say that therapists should be questioning their clients' estrangement beliefs, not affirming them. They warn that patients are not always reliable narrators, especially if they have mental health issues. And the therapist is hearing only one side of the story. This can lead to two major problems, according to Jay Lebo, senior scholar and senior therapist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University, who says he often sees patients in his practice who have been encouraged by previous therapists to sever ties with a loved one. You're not solving the right problem, which is the mental health crisis, he said. And this is the most tragic. You may be encouraging them to cut off their best source of support. Critics also argue that there is no scientific evidence that separating from a close relative is inherently beneficial. And the long-term damage, including broken relationships with siblings, grandchildren, and parents as they age, is often unanticipated. You can have somebody die during the estrangement, said Christine Troney, a licensed clinical social worker in Latice, Pennsylvania, who often sees clients who are grieving the impact of estrangements they initiated. There are lifelong consequences. Indeed, research from Cornell's Pillemer and colleagues shows that while people who start a cutoff often feel a temporary sense of relief, they also experience significantly higher rates of chronic unhappiness and depression over time. Rubley was a young woman living abroad when her therapist surprised her by recommending she cut off her mom. Her childhood had been chaotic after her parents divorced when she was a toddler, she says, but she did not view it as so extreme. I went in expecting to focus on boundaries, said Rubley, who lives near Corridor, Idaho. I thought that meant better self-discipline and better communication. Rubley tried to push back, but her therapist framed her concerns as blind spots that impeded healing, she says. So she stopped talking to her mom. I thought it wasn't permanent, that it was just fewer phone calls when I was in my therapy process, she says. The estrangement lasted 10 years, despite her mom repeatedly reaching out. During that time, Rubley fell in love, got married, and lost two grandparents. She also experienced other family members cutting her off in anger over the estrangement. It was really hard, she said. There were all these unintended consequences. Then Rubley had children of her own and realized all parents have flaws. So one day she called her mother and the two began talking again. I was thrilled to hear from her, says her mom, Anne Pendler, 69, of Cedar Key, Florida. It was a real trial, but I always figured that someday she would realize she had made a mistake. Ruby deeply regrets taking the therapist's advice, but says she blames herself. At the end of the day, you cannot hold them accountable, she says. And now, can we kill you for your organs, please? In a recent New England Journal of Medicine article, three medical academics, two of whom are bioethicists, argue that the growing acceptance of voluntary euthanasia warrants a recontextualization of the dead doctor rule and assessment of the ethical principles involved. Behind the obscurantist language is a horrifying proposal, which co-author Robert Chuag described in an interview. Patients would receive an anesthetic, and under anesthesia, the organs would be removed while they are still functioning. Assisted suicide raises enough ethical questions as it is. The National Council on Disability, in which I serve, noted in a 2019 report that longstanding concern that if assisted suicide is legal, some people's lives, particularly those of people with disabilities, will be ended without their fully informed and free consent through mistakes, abuse, insufficient knowledge, and the unjust lack of better options. Exploiting assisted suicide to increase the supply of donated organs would increase the likelihood that vulnerable patients will feel pressured to end their lives. Apart from whether it violates state criminal statutes regarding euthanasia and murder, federal policy should forbid the ghoulish, macabre practice the authors call death by organ donation before it begins. The Trump administration should immediately issue guidance specifying that a 1997 law prohibiting federal funding of assisted suicide applies to any instances of deaths via organ donation. If Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal insurance options and grant programs refuse to cover the cost of an organ transplant that is the product of assisted suicide, fewer hospitals will contemplate undertaking them. In addition, the Department of Health and Human Services should direct the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network to adopt a policy explicitly prohibiting death via organ donation. The OPTN's policies carry great weight because Section 1138 of the Social Security Act provides that transplant hospitals may participate in Medicare and Medicaid only if the hospital is a member of and abides by the rules and requirements of OPTN. With all Medicare and Medicaid payments contingent on compliance with OPTN policies, a single instance of death by organ donation would put a hospital's existence in jeopardy. Ultimately, Congress should amend the National Organ Transplant Act to prohibit organ donations caused by assisted suicide, just as it already prohibits the interstate sales of human organs. A recent bicameral letter calling for monitoring of hospice patients regarding so-called aid in dying illustrates bipartisan concern that vulnerable patients could be pressured into ending their lives. That suggests there could be broad bipartisan support for a prohibition on deaths via organ donation, as there was for the 1997 law on assisted suicide and the 2023 law reforming the organ transplant system. As a mother of a child with cystic fibrosis, I recognize the anguish that patients in need of a life-saving organ transplant face. But we can do better than killing people, even people who claim they wish to die, to harvest their organs. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back with more articles. Thank you for listening.